discussing step one, part two, which is admitted we were powerless over alcohol and that our lives had become unmanageable. I'd like you guys to help me welcome our panel. Tonight we have Margaret and Glenn. So how this is gonna work, I'm gonna read the first paragraph, which tonight is on page 5. And then the panel will share for a few minutes each on the reading. So starting off on page 5. I woke up. This had to be stopped. I saw I could not take so much as one drink. I was through forever. Before then, I had written lots of sweet promises, but my wife happily observed that this time I meant business, and so I did. Shortly afterward, I came home drunk. There had been no fight. Where had been my high resolve? I simply didn't know. It hadn't even come to mind. Someone had pushed a drink my way, and I had taken it. Was I crazy? I began to wonder, for such an appalling lack of perspective seemed near being just that. Renewing my resolve, I tried again. Some time passed, and confidence began to be replaced by cocksureness. I could laugh at the gin mills. Now I had what it takes. One day I walked into a cafe to telephone. In no time, I was beating on the bar, asking myself how it happened. As the whiskey rose to my head, I told myself I would manage better next time, but I might as well get good and drunk then, and I did. Margaret?
My name is Margaret. I'm an alcoholic. The first thing I remember, or I can relate to, is the first line here. I woke up. This had to be stopped. The time I remember for the first time waking up and realizing this had to be stopped, I was 17. I began drinking when I was about 15, but it right away was something that I took to, and it took to me. And I wanted to drink whenever I could, as often as I could, as much as I could. Started getting in trouble at school, kind of just changed my personality, who I hung out with. And then February of my senior year of high school, my cousin and I were doing college trips, mostly involving going somewhere far away where nobody was watching us and drinking. And we were in Minnesota, and we took a train trip to Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Supposed to be a 6-hour train trip. We went down there, we spent the weekend, drank a lot, and one thing I remember is the young woman that I was staying with, my host, I made some joke about, yeah, this is great, and the bars or something, and she said, if you don't want to work, you shouldn't even come here. And it really hit me, because I thought, well, I don't want to work. What am I going to do? And but I could deal with that. Well, there was a blizzard, and way back from Milwaukee back to St. Paul, and the train got stuck for hours. I don't remember. I mean, it was a really long time, like 12 hours, a really long time, and I was out of everything. I was out of money. I was out of cigarettes. I didn't have anything to drink. I had nothing. I didn't have food. I had nothing, and we were all just kind of stuck on this train, so I pretty much had to just sit there and be present, you know, be with myself, and I kind of thought back over the weekend. I thought about the previous year. I looked around the train at some other young women my age and thought, I woke up. I guess I'm going to quote this. I woke up and realized this had to be stopped, because I started playing out the path I was on and thought, this is not going to go anywhere very good. I mean, I'm only 17. And that was when I quit the first time. I did a really good job. That was February, and I didn't drink through the spring and the summer. I got two jobs. As soon as school got out, I was working at an overnight grocery store, waiting tables in the day, and then a few hours I would sleep between those two, because I really was serious. This had to be stopped. I couldn't start my new life and go to college and be drinking. But that particular part of this reading is the first time I remember waking up and saying this had to be stopped.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Glenn Mifflin.
Glenn.
Sobriety date, January 16th, 1995. I got a home group here in Norfolk, Big Book in Ghent, Tuesdays at 5:30. If you find yourself with something you need to do around that time on Tuesdays, please come by and visit us. We'd be glad to have you. Unfortunately, I didn't have a whole lot of want to as far as stopping. I said the words a couple of times while I was married, but up until that point, there was never an issue with which I had the desire to wake up and stop. It just didn't happen. The times that it did, when the heat was on, when I was married, I'd say, yeah, I'll quit, and then I acted out for a couple weeks as, you know, being the biggest jerk I could be, and finally she would go out and buy it for me, and say, you need to drink this so that you quit being the way you are, and I said, the plan worked. So, there were times though when I'd look at myself and wonder, was I crazy with the kind of effort I was putting into drinking, what I was doing, how I was doing it, the volume of what I was drinking. It was just incredible looking back on it. But as far as any times of sobriety, 2 weeks is nothing to really talk about. The last 9 years of my drinking, only alcoholics have drinking careers, but the last 9 years of my drinking career was pretty much a solid 9 years. The only time I didn't drink was when I physically could not get up from the bed to drink. That was the only time, and those times were very few. So I spent a good 9 years every day, just doing it every day, every day. Just the same thing every day. So when I read this, I don't necessarily have a lot to relate to in this particular paragraph, but the fact that I did act crazily after I've seen myself through sober eyes, really, it just amazes me looking back at it and seeing the destruction I had, the amount of effort I put into drinking, and the amount of at least the volume of what I drank. It's just incredible to speak of. So that's it.
Thanks. All right, our second reading is on page 7. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth in high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer, self-knowledge.
Okay, my name is Margaret. I'm an alcoholic. This reminds me of how it says it relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor. And it reminds me of the reading of the doctor's opinion when I came in, and that I was relieved because I knew something was wrong with me, and it relieved me to learn that I wasn't completely morally defective and had no willpower. And I could see this, and the only way I could function through for certain periods of time was to completely stop. I didn't want it to be that way, but when I would come to a point in my life where something had to change, I would have to completely stop. And I could do that for certain periods of time. I had to use lots of tools, like getting multiple jobs or just keeping super, super busy. I remember I flunked out of the first college I went to. I did a bunch of things, and then I when I went back to college, I knew if I was going to succeed with this, I had to absolutely not drink, and no matter what. And I had a lot of rules for myself, and I wrote everything down. I had a little notebook, and I would write down what I ate, how many miles I ran, how many vitamins I took. I mean, I can't remember. I was gonna keep this thing under control if I ate the right things and I ran a certain number of miles. And I can't remember all the things, but I had a real notebook that I kept it all recorded in. And I found that notebook after I got sober. And the irony was that I never wrote down what I drank. Because on weekends I was allowed, it was out in the country, the school was out in the country, I didn't have a car. But there was a little grocery store, this little country store that sold bread and milk and beer. And I would get a six-pack and go out in the cow fields behind the store and sit in the fields, like, among the cow patties and drink the six-pack by myself. And be like, whew, thank goodness. But I never wrote that down in my notebooks. It was like this thing that I just had to do, and then I could go and use my strong willpower in other respects. I did not think that was unmanageable. I thought I was managing very well and writing it all down. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you.
You know, I did say that I didn't have a great want to quit drinking at any given time, but I do know now that when I did try, that was the best effort that I could have given at that time. It was everything I had to give to quitting. At one time, I would have told you that I didn't make the effort, but the reality is that I made it a maximum effort trying. I just couldn't do it, and at the time, didn't know why. I have a hard time with this still, thinking that my will is weak, because I've accepted that fact later on that we find out that, you know, I've lost the power of choice. I've accepted that, so I don't know that my will had anything to do with it. I could will everything I wanted to, and it wouldn't have made any difference. So, but when it comes to other things, I'm very willful. I'm very strong-willed about a lot of stuff. And sometimes I have to be beaten down pretty bad to give up. So when it comes to the will, as far as drinking and alcohol, you know, I accept that today. I've lost everything that has to do with alcohol altogether. And fortunately, it's been removed from my life. I've had that thing removed, and I no longer have to deal with it. I did have desperation when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at a point where I didn't know what I was going to do. I didn't have anything left to fight this thing. And I didn't realize that I had already lost a long time ago. That battle had been lost way, way before I even realized it was a battle. So I had to come to the understanding that my will was not going to do it. And the idea that I was going to be able to do anything substantially about it had to be brought to me and had to sink down into my innermost being, because if I even think that I have just a hair of a chance, I'm going to continue on fighting. That's just the way it is in me. And I understand that a lot of us are that way. That if we have a lurking notion, we're going to continue on. And that's the way I was. I was going to continue on until I had absolutely no way of getting out of it. That's it.
Thank y'all. Our third reading is on page 24, starting with the fact. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of even a week or a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove.
I didn't think I'd be able to drink like other people. I knew that young. I knew that in high school, that I didn't drink like other people. I had to find the other people that drank like I did. And the power of choice, it was all or nothing. I could rationalize that. I would say if I gave up drinking, I remember telling my sister one time that I wasn't going to drink for Lent. in, she said, I thought you gave up drinking for Lent. And I said, I thought about it, but really, you should just pray more. You shouldn't, you shouldn't, like, give stuff up. You should. So I decided that since drinking isn't a problem for me, I'm going to drink and then I'll just pray more. It's like, okay. She's the one who used to have to, like, pick me up and put me to bed. So I don't know if she believed me. But my power of choice, I wouldn't say I had a choice, but I changed my mind. And I changed my mind, or I decided to drink because I was getting kind of tense and it really wasn't fair, you know, for me to be all tense and crabby. And so I decided to drink. And so I sort of felt like I had, you know, some choice. I just changed my mind. So that's about the choice. I know when I graduated eventually after 7 years from college, there was kind of this horror, this impending doom, that because then I was supposed to show up and be an adult and get a job, and I wasn't sure how that was going to really happen. So I know the advisors were saying, you know, why don't you try, if you thought about education, you could teach. And all I could think was having to be somewhere at 7 o'clock in the morning, like functional, with people looking at me expecting me to be able to, you know, perform. And I it was a nice idea, but I just kind of knew that could never happen. I didn't even know that I knew that. All I know is that I ruled that out really quickly. And that was why. I already knew in me that I didn't have a choice about whether or not I was going to drink the night before a work day. So I actually decided not to get one of those kind of jobs. Mm-hmm. And instead I did a year of full-time volunteer work because I wanted to be spiritual. And that was another one of my rationalizations is, I'm not just gonna go out there on the quest for money and success. I'm gonna go out and serve. I'm gonna live a spiritual way of life. Well, the reality is, if you're a volunteer, I mean, you sort of have a little more leeway as far as, you know, the kind of things I was doing. If I didn't, you know, show up or I wasn't very alert, what are they going to do? But I was all about, like, I want to be of service. And so, again, I felt like I made a choice to do that year, but the reality was I could not have gotten and held a job, and I knew that somewhere in me. So I really didn't have a choice. I just had a lot of good excuses.
Today, I don't think the reasons for me, at least, are that obscure that I've lost the power of choice, because, like it says in the doctor's opinion, you know, I suffer from an allergy of the body, and once I put alcohol in my body, then I start chasing that allergy. I start trying to put more to it because my body says I need more, I need more, I need more. My brain says start pouring more into you, you know, because you got to satisfy this thing. And if I'm removed from alcohol, that obsession takes over and all I do is think about it. So this whole idea that this is obscure today is really not so much for me. I'm going to drink today. Even 23 some odd years away from the last one, I could drink just as easily today as I did when I first came in here if I'm not spiritually fit. I'm not immune from this unless I do what it tells me to do. And I have to remember that. There's nothing that's going to stop me from drinking if I don't stay close to this program and my higher power. Because I'm not going to stop me. That's my nature. It's my nature to drink. That's what I do. I've always been that way, and I always will be that way. So to think that I might have someday gotten back to the realm of choice is just an insane idea. And like I said earlier, you know, God removed that from me. I don't have to deal with it today, and I don't want a choice today, because if I have a choice today, I know what I'll do. You know, it's not a matter of when, it's just, or if, it's when. When am I going to do it? So not having a choice is fine with me today. God can have it. Don't want it. Glad it's gone. And unfortunately, they had to use beer as an example because I was a beer drinker, and I hate that they use that as the thing that might, you know, that little bit of beer. You know, I drank a lot of beer, but I don't think that it's just, you know, liquor drinkers that have a problem. I had a huge problem because I drank a lot of beer. So one of the things I have to remember also that this idea of consciousness, you know, coming to my mind what I'd done the night before or whatever, weeks before, I was a blackout drinker. That was something that happened my second time out. And when I had that experience, unlike a lot of people, I thought it was a good thing because I didn't remember anything. And if I don't remember it, it didn't happen. That's just the way it is. I could be told that I did this, that, and the other, but inside of me, I'm saying, I wasn't there. You know, it's my, Donald will understand this, my alibi against being guilty of the crime that I committed. So, you know, I had my alibi. I wasn't there. I was not consciously there, so I didn't do it. And so when it comes to remembering those things, people can tell me about it. If I don't remember it, it didn't happen. I don't have to worry about it. That sounds kind of hard and harsh, but it's that delusion that I'd created or that fantasy I created around me to protect what I was doing from anything interfering with that. And that's what I spent a lot of time with, a lot of time with. That's it.
Thank you. Our fourth reading is on page 30. And it is, most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to think he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We learned that we had to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people, or presently maybe, has to be smashed. We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt at times we were regaining control, but such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led in time to pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable time period, we get worse, never better.
My last drunk was in a women's house where I had fled after falling apart in various ways on my volunteer year. And they took me in, they helped me out, and I didn't drink for the first month. And then I got a phone call that my grandfather had died and that I had to travel several states away to be with my family, and I couldn't deal with that without drinking. So I drank. I hadn't drank, as I said, for about a month, and had a blowout, bad drunk, and to the point where I was hallucinating on cheap red wine, and messed up this house, people who had taken me in, and after that was all over, after about a week, the director of the house sat me down and said, do you think you might be an alcoholic? And I was really indignant that somebody would use that term about me. And I said, absolutely not. I have done a lot of drinking for a lot of years, and if I was going to be an alcoholic, I'd be an alcoholic by now. So she wisely dropped it. But I was scared. I mean, that was a scary, scary drunk. And so I didn't drink. And plus, they were watching me. They had to clean up after me. And I didn't have anywhere else to live, and I didn't have any, you know, I wasn't functional, so I had to stay there. So I was desperate to not drink while I was there. I was desperate to have a place to live. And I did not drink for 4 months. It was hell. It was complete hell. I was so angry, I couldn't even see straight. I couldn't sleep. It was awful, and I was so conscious of alcohol everywhere I was. I would, they'd send me out to clean houses sometimes, and I knew in those houses, I knew where the alcohol was. It was like, if I went in the room, I remember one house, they had a corner cabinet and had a television set, and then the doors underneath at an angle, and I knew that's where the liquor was. And it was like calling to me. I mean, it was like a magnet, and I was nervous when I cleaned that room. But I just couldn't drink after that last drunk. And I would wake up at night, and I would leave, and I would pace the hills, a little town in upstate New York. I would pace up and down the hills, like just pounding my feet into the ground and just wanting to kill somebody. I mean, I just hoped somebody would come along and cross me because I was gonna kill them. I just didn't need any excuse. I was furious. And after 4 months, the anger couldn't keep me sober anymore. And I came to a point where I knew I was gonna drink, and I was really scared because I didn't know what was gonna happen. I mean, I never did, but it had been pretty bad the last time. And I was watching myself wearing the same clothes. It was a brown sweater and brown corduroys. And I wasn't, you know, combing my hair, and I was eating. I mean, the last day when I finally asked for help, I was eating out of a trash can. I just was so just down, and just I couldn't do it anymore. And that the grace of that is, I got on my knees and I said, God, I don't want to drink anymore, and I can't stop. Please help me. Because I knew I was going to drink in the next few hours, and I didn't know how that was going to end up, and I was terrified. And what I knew in that moment was that I needed to tell somebody. I needed to say that out loud to somebody and ask for help. And I went to the woman who 4 months before had asked me if I thought I might be an alcoholic. And I said, will you... I'm having trouble here. I don't want to drink, and I can't not drink. Can you lock me in the guest room for a few days? I will do all my work. If people will cover my work, I'll make up for them. If just let me out to go to the bathroom and bring me some food. I just need a few days locked up because I'm not going to be able to not drink. And there's no other way I'm going to be able to stop. And she said, I could do that, but I think what's really going to help you is to talk to some other alcoholics. And I heard her say other alcoholics, and I knew she was calling me an alcoholic, and I did not care. I thought, whatever I am, whatever you want to call me, I can't go on like this. And I had had the experiment of quitting for a period of time, and all my power, my willpower, I couldn't do it anymore. And so anyway, the next day I was in my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. That was September 20th, 1986. And that day I needed to be locked up to not drink. I haven't had a drink since, and I've never been locked up in those years. And that's AA. I mean, it was meetings and God, certainly, and sponsorship. But that was an important bottom for me because I had tried everything to quit. And that was the last thing. I was going to have to be locked up because I knew that there was nothing else that was going to keep me from drinking. And that convinced me that I was powerless and my life was unmanageable. Thanks.
I like this passage out of the book. Probably it's one of my favorite. I use this. I either read it before I speak or when I speak because it reminds me of what I've been through and who I am and what I will be if I don't continue down this path that's been provided for me. I was willing to admit some that I was an alcoholic when I came to AA. I thought I was done. I thought I was beaten. But like I said before, there was this lurking notion still that hadn't given up. And when it talks about countless vain attempts, that last vain attempt that I tried lasted for 7.5 years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. I did service. I was real good at service because of whatever my personal makeup is. You know, I was good at doing that. And that's what I did. And I didn't do anything else. I gave, you know, a passing glance at the other things, but I did service. I didn't do recovery. I didn't do unity, as my sponsor would gratefully tell you. But I did service. I was really good at it. And that lasted for 7.5 years. And it got to a point where at one time I was asked, after reading this last part out of chapter 2 about the guy who wouldn't drink even if he could, I was asked that question, would you drink if you could get away with it? And I hesitated, and I thought about it, and he said, anybody that's in the right place, they don't have to think about it. The answer is no. And I realized then that I was very, very much in trouble. I was in a real bad place, so I had to do something. And what I did was I talked to my current, you know, the sponsor I had, and I said, look, I've got to do something different. And he said, good, find somebody else. And I think I have. And so what I ended up doing was going back through the steps again. And it was the most excruciatingly painful thing I've ever done in my life because my ego was back. And I had certain rights given to me by me at that point after 7.5 years that I shouldn't have to do this again and I shouldn't have to suffer through this painful stuff again. The funny part is I hadn't suffered through the painful stuff yet at all. That's the funny thing. You know, it's really weird how my mind works and tries to make excuses for me. But I clawed my way through it. I refused. I screamed. I hollered. I cried. I did everything I could. And the whole time, you know, my sponsor at the time was laughing at me, which didn't help a whole lot either. It really hurt my feelings a lot to be laughed at my silliness. Today, it's funny. It's just, you know, it's a huge cartoon today. But back then, I was seriously hurt. And I was very pitiful at that time, too. So that idea that I had to concede to my innermost self was something that took a long time to happen. It was very, very difficult for me to come to that realization and to concede that I was a real alcoholic because I didn't think I was. I was pretty sure I wasn't. And had I not done that delusion that I had created that I wasn't like you guys, that I somehow could skirt the issue, if I hadn't come to that realization that I was like you guys, I would have been back to that insanity and death thing. That's where I was headed back for. I was holding my position as an alcoholic to the gates of insanity or death. That's what I decided to do because I didn't want to concede that I was that way, that I was a true alcoholic and that I had absolutely no choice in the matter and I had absolutely no power to do anything about it. You know, I hadn't discovered a higher power at that point. I gave it, you know, lip service, but I hadn't discovered a higher power. The second time through the steps, I found that higher power. I've been told a lot of times, and I've come to understand it more and more lately, that when I'm having problems, anything in my life, in Alcoholics Anonymous, anything, that I'm suffering from a first step problem and I've realized that I'm not like you again, that all of a sudden I've got power and I don't have to do what you're doing. I can get away without doing it. And what happens is things start falling apart again. It's real subtle, but I start having interpersonal problems. I start rubbing people the wrong way. They rub me the wrong way. All this stuff starts happening again when I don't pay attention to what I'm doing. And that's a first step problem. I have to go back and realize that I've somehow or another found power outside of what I know and decided that I was the power again. And I have the ability to do what I need to do for me on a daily basis. And the reality is that I don't have that ability. I haven't had that ability forever, as far as I'm concerned. I haven't had it. And I have to depend on something or someone else, something else greater than me to provide me with the ability, the courage, and the power to do what I need to do on a daily basis. And that's a fact today in my life. I try to live that way. I'm not always perfect at it, like I can't imagine anybody is. But I try to live that way, and when I, like I did recently, got off the beam a little bit, I can't say I was hurt, but you know, things happened that caused me to realize what I had done was, or what I had done to cause that to happen. And I had to start back through the thing again and do again what I know that I need to do to get things corrected and get back on the beam. The idea that, again, I'll never recover control over alcohol. I'm glad that I know that today. But I also have to remember that that second half applies too, that I'll never gain control over my life again. I've also lost that manageability that I tried to do in my life, tried to create things that would make me happy and make things right and make it so that I'm not unhappy or I'm not anxious or I'm not whatever. I won't have that ability returned to me either. So when I start trying to do that, things are going to fall apart too. You know, I've got to remember that because of this first step, my hands have to stay off everything. I have to turn to my higher power for all the stuff that I need, and it will be provided. Maybe not when I want it, but it'll be provided. I have to remember that. And through that 7.5 year period that I get to reflect back on, I know that patience with the stuff coming is probably something I need to practice as well. Because it took me that long just to get through step one. And that's not what I would recommend anybody, but you know, that's what it took for me. But I was real fortunate to get to stay here long enough to understand that I was powerless and that my life is not manageable by me in any way. That's it.
Thank you. Next reading is on page 41. As soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I had made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time I had not thought of the consequences at all. I had commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesied that if I had an alcoholic mind, the time and place would come, I would drink again. They had said that though I did raise a defense, it would one day give way before some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help in those strange mental blank spots. I had never been able to understand people who said that a problem had them hopelessly defeated. I knew then it was a crushing blow.
I don't ever remember going carefully over an evening after I drank and trying to figure it out. Sometimes I had bad luck. sometimes things didn't work out. I don't think I thought that I had, that self-knowledge would help me. I did think I needed more willpower. And I do know the unmanageability. I still remember early on, somebody brought up the topic at one of my early meetings and said, I don't get it. I stopped drinking and my life is unmanageable. And the first person who spoke said, yeah, your life is unmanageable by you. And that has stayed in my head all these years, because when I start saying to myself, this is unmanageable, I need to remember my life is unmanageable by me. And if I've jumped ahead into the third step, I'm not even supposed to be managing it. So that's it for me.
One of the things I've learned recently through a lot of book reading and talking and book study and what have you is that, you know, I'm suffering from a mental illness. And the idea that my self-knowledge through my mentally ill brain is going to have any effect on anything is sort of comical in itself. You know, it's like a mentally ill brain trying to fix a situation that is unfixable. It's just amazing to me that I think that way. But I was one of those that thought, you know, if I figure out all the bells and whistles of my behavior and all that kind of stuff, then I'm pretty sure that things will go right, you know, that I'll be able to be okay. But, you know, self-knowledge is of no use to me in my situation as far as being an alcoholic. I mean, it says somewhere, I think it's in the 12 and 12, I'm not sure, but, you know, self-knowledge is great as far as it goes, which for me doesn't go very far, you know, as far as helping me. So I have to remember that just because I know what happened and why it happened, that's not going to change the fact that I'm an alcoholic. And that's not going to help change anything that I do. I have to have something else come into me, into my life, and affect that change that's necessary. Otherwise, this knowledge is just going to be sitting there on the table. It's not going to come into play at all. It just won't. So I have to remember that. I have to remember that it's also good to know what happened and why, but it's not going to change anything if I don't follow through with the rest of it. You know, place it in God's hands, ask for the difficulties that I have to be removed, and then try to help somebody else. That's what I have to remember. That's the process. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to start going backwards. I'm going to start backpedaling all the way. So I have to keep that in mind. And it has to be something I practice on a daily basis, hopefully. Because if I don't, then I'm going to lose track of where I am. That's it.
Thank you. Our final reading is on page 43. Once more, the alcoholic at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink, except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. His defense must come from a higher power.
When I think of times that I've thought about drinking, wanted to drink, I know that my only defense came from a higher power. I remember I was driving down, I was hungry, angry, lonely, tired, driving down Virginia Beach Boulevard, and it was night, and I went past a Mexican restaurant, and everything in me wanted to go in there and get drunk. And what crossed my mind, I was sponsoring somebody named Julie at the time, and I remember I said, oh, that would kill Julie. And I kept going. And why I would care about somebody else when I wanted to drink is not me. I mean, that was a higher power. Any time that I've been saved from myself from drinking is clearly from a higher power, because no other human being could provide such a defense, although he has used other human beings many times. I will get a phone call from somebody, I'll read something, I'll go to a meeting and hear what I need to hear. But it is amazing how my mind works, because that comes up. That is my go-to when, in certain, not even rare cases, I mean, I'm going to drink. Crazy stuff. I remember one time my husband called and said, I'm making homemade pasta, and I've got a salad, but can you stop by the bakery and pick up a loaf of bread? And I said, yeah, I'll get a bottle of wine. And I'd been sober like 12 years at the time. And then I was like, holy cow, what just happened there? It's just, so anyway, that wasn't, I caught that one. But God has had to protect me from myself, because who I am is somebody who drinks. That's it.
You know, as I said before, you know, the idea of a mental defense with this sick-ass brain, you know, is kind of funny. You know, I'm gonna come up with something that's gonna stop me from drinking. It's not likely that that's gonna happen. But the idea that no human power is gonna be able to help me, that has to include me, because I'm part of that human race. So I don't have any power, and nobody outside of my higher power has any ability to really have a solid effect on this. It has to come, the things that I need have to come from a power greater than that. And that's a strange thing for an individual that believes in touching and feeling things in order for it to be real. That's something I grew up with. You know, I spent a lot of my education in science. And if you can't touch or feel it, it isn't there, which is really not true. The reality is that there's a lot that we can't touch, see, or feel that is actually there. So I have to remember that. And like I told that story, you know, what else but a higher power stepped in when that guy asked me, you know, would you drink? What else happened? I mean, I could have said anything at that time, and I could have responded any way. But the first thing I did was start the process toward a greater recovery. That wasn't me taking that action. I was pushed by something else. That's something I've had to realize. That wasn't my action. That was my higher power's action on me. And I have to keep that in mind, that these things that happen for me, I don't get to take credit for. You know, I was a participant, but I didn't start the thing, I didn't keep it rolling, and I certainly fought the thing all the way through. You know, that's something I did. And there's a witness here that will tell you that. But I have to remember that I'm not the one that did all this stuff. And if I keep that in my mind, then that defense is going to always be there. That higher power is going to always be there to protect me from the things that I'm powerless against. And that's just the fact of my life today. And I'm really thankful for that. I'm thankful I know that today. I'm grateful for the opportunity that I was given to spend numerous years getting to that point. You know, a lot of people give up way before that, and I was real fortunate to get to stay here. I think it has a lot to do with me being stubborn. You know, I wasn't willing to give up. I stayed here long enough to where it finally worked through me, or on me, or whatever. So I'm really thankful that I had that opportunity. That's it.
Thank y'all so much. All right. I'm now going to pass the seventh tradition basket. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district area, and the general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, which is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Although the amount of our contribution is secondary to the spiritual connection that unites all groups around the world, we may want to remember that a dollar does not support as many services as it used to. At this time, are there any AA-related announcements?
Hi, my name is Jim. I'm not bored. The Veterans Disabled Home down in Virginia Beach is looking for volunteers to come in and speak with the veterans. They started an AA meeting down there for disabled veterans. It just started up a few weeks ago, and we can use people to come down there and read the book with them, share your story, the whole line. I know it. If anybody's interested, it's at 904 Broad Meadow Boulevard, Virginia Beach. You can see me. It's on Thursday nights at 6 o'clock. I can use all the help that I can get to get people down there and everything. So we can also take it back to your home groups and all. I'd appreciate that. But yeah, come see me and I can give you any information you need about it. It's for disabled veterans, so appreciate the help.
Thank you. Anybody else? All righty. Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group, please see one of us after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hand. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would like to welcome you.
Go ahead. My name's Campbell. I'm not a
college. Hey, welcome.
My name's Mike. I'm not a college.
Welcome. We have literature available for sale over there. If you'd like to purchase anything, please see me or any home group member after the meeting, and the pamphlets are free. Sponsorship questions. Sponsorship in AA is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, I will be available at this table after we close the meeting. Please feel free to talk to me. Reminder, smokers, please use the butt can provided outside and stay well away from the church doors. All meeting audio recordings and upcoming events are posted on our website, which is simpleactions.net. In closing, can we thank our panel? Thanks to all who participated. After we clean up, all are invited and encouraged to continue the conversation on step one tonight at the meeting after the meeting, which will be held at Plaza del Sol on Colonial and 22nd Street. Could I have a volunteer to read the last two paragraphs on page 164? Jim?
I'm Aaron Jim, I'm not Paul. Our book is meant to be suggestive. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answer will come if your own house is in order. But honestly, you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is a great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellow clear away the wreckage of your past. Give fully of that of what you have you find, and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you. Until then.
Thank you. We're going to close with the Lord's Prayer.
Thank you, Margaret. That was awesome.
I needed this. I did.
I'm not here.
Our Father.
But deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power.